Chapter 25. You see, we'll demand that she should be made to hit the iceberg very accurately with her nose, because should you perchance scrape the bluff of the bow instead, she may, without ceasing to be as unsinkable as before, find her way to the bottom. I congratulate the future transatlantic passengers on the new and vigorous sensations in store for them. They shall go bounding across from iceberg to iceberg at 25 knots with precision and safety, and a cheerful bumpy sound as the immortal poem has it. It will be a teeth-loosening, exhilarating experience. The decorations will be Louis Quinn's, of course, and the cafe shall remain open all night. But what about the priceless Sèvres porcelain, and the Venetian glass provided for the service of transatlantic passengers? Well, I am afraid all that will have to be replaced by silver goblets and plates. Nasty common cheap silver. But those who will go to sea must be prepared to put up with a certain amount of hardship. And there shall be no boats. Why should there be no boats? Because Pooh Bah said that the fewer the boats, the more people can be saved, and therefore with no boats at all, no one need be lost. But even if there was a flaw in this argument, pray look at the other advantages the absence of boats gives you. There can't be the annoyance of having to go into them in the middle of the night, and the unpleasantness, after saving your life by the skin of your teeth, of being hauled over the coals by your approachable members of the bar with hints that you are no better than a cowardly scoundrel, and your wife a heartless monster. Less boats. No boats. Great should be the gratitude of passage selling combines to Pooh Bah, and they ought to cherish his memory when he dies. But no fear of that. His kind never dies. All you have to do, O Combine, is to knock at the door of the Marine Department, look in, and beckon to the first man you see. That will be he, very much at your service, prepared to affirm after N years of my best consideration, and a bundle of statistics in hand, that there's no lesson to be learned, and that there is nothing to be done. On an earlier day there was another witness before the Court of Inquiry. A mighty official of the White Star Line. The impression of his testimony which the report gave is of an almost scornful impatience with all this fuss and pother. Boats. Of course we have crowded our decks with them in answer to this ignorant clamor. Mere lumber. How can we handle so many boats with our davits? Your people don't know the conditions of the problem. We have given these matters our best consideration, and we have done what we thought reasonable. We have done more than our duty. We are wise, and good, and impeccable. And whoever says otherwise is either ignorant or wicked. This is the gist of these scornful answers which disclose the psychology of commercial undertakings. It is the same psychology which 50 or so years ago, before Samuel Plimsoll uplifted his voice, sent overloaded ships to sea. Why shouldn't we cram in as much cargo as our ships will hold? Look how very few of them get lost, after all. Men don't change. Not very much. And the only answer to be given to this manager who came out, impatient and indignant, from behind the plate glass windows of his shop, to be discovered by this inquiry, and to tell us that they, the whole 3 million or 30 million, for all I know, capital organization for selling passages has considered the problem of boats, the only answer to give him is that this is not a problem of boats at all. It is the problem of decent behavior. If you can't carry or handle so many boats, then don't cram quite so many people on board. It is as simple as that. This problem of right feeling and right conduct, the real nature of which seems beyond the comprehension of ticket providers. Don't sell so many tickets, my virtuous dignitary. After all, men and women, unless considered from a purely commercial point of view, are not exactly the cattle of the Western Ocean trade, that used some 20 years ago to be thrown overboard on an emergency, and left to swim round and round before they sank. If you can't get more boats, then sell less tickets. don't drown so many people on the finest, calmest night that was ever known in the North Atlantic, even if you have provided them with a little music to get drowned by. Sell less tickets. That's the solution of the problem, Your Mercantile Highness. But there would be a cry, oh, this requires consideration. 10 years of it, eh? Well, no. This does not require consideration. This is the very first thing to do. At once. Limit the number of people by the boats you can handle. That's honesty. And then you may go on fumbling for years about these precious davits which are such a stumbling block to your humanity. These fascinating patent davits. These davits that refuse to do 3 times as much work as they were meant to do. Oh, the wickedness of these davits. One of the great discoveries of this admirable inquiry is the fascination of the davits. All these people positively can't get away from them. They shuffle about and groan around their davits. Whereas the obvious thing to do is to eliminate the manhandle davits altogether. Don't you think that with all the mechanical contrivances, with all the generated power on board these ships, it is about time to get rid of the 100-year-old manpower appliances? Cranes are what is wanted. Low, compact cranes with adjustable heads, one to each set of 6 or 9 boats. And if people tell you of insuperable difficulties, if they tell you of the swing and spin of span boats, don't you believe them. The heads of the cranes need not be any higher than the heads of the davits. The lift required would be only a couple of inches. As to the spin, there is a way to prevent that, if you have in each boat 2 men who know what they are about. I have taken up on board a heavy ship's boat, in the open sea, the ship rolling heavily, with a common cargo derrick. And a cargo derrick is very much like a crane, but a crane devised ad hoc would be infinitely easier to work. We must remember that the loss of this ship has altered the moral atmosphere. As long as the Titanic is remembered, an ugly rush for the boats may be feared in case of some accident. You can't hope to drill into perfect discipline a casual mob of 600 firemen and waiters, but in a ship like the Titanic you can keep on a permanent trustworthy crew of 100 intelligent seamen and mechanics who would know their stations for abandoning ship, and would do the work efficiently. The boats could be lowered with sufficient dispatch. One does not want to let rip one's boats by the run all at the same time. With 6 boat cranes, 6 boats would be simultaneously swung, filled, and got away from the side. And if any sort of order is kept, the ship could be cleared of the passengers in a quite short time. For there must be boats enough for the passengers and crew. Whether you increase the number of boats or limit the number of passengers, irrespective of the size of the ship, that is the only honest course. Any other would be rather worse than putting sand in the sugar, for which a tradesman gets fined or imprisoned. Do not let us take a romantic view of the so-called progress. A company selling passages is a tradesman, though from the way these people talk and behave you would think they are benefactors of mankind in some mysterious way, engaged in some lofty and amazing enterprise. All these boats should have a motor engine in them. And, of course, the glorified tradesmen, the mummified official, the technicians, and all these secretly disconcerted hangers-on to the enormous ticket-selling enterprise, will raise objections to it with every air of superiority. But don't believe them. Doesn't it strike you as absurd that in this age of mechanical propulsion, of generated power, the boats of such ultra-modern ships are fitted with oars and sails, implements more than 3,000 years old? Old as the siege of Troy. Older, and I know what I am talking about. Only 6 weeks ago I was on the river in an ancient, rough, ship's boat, fitted with a 2-cylinder motor engine of 7.5 HPP, just a common ship's boat, which the man who owns her uses for taking the workmen and stevedores to and from the ship's loading at the buoys off Greenhithe. She would have carried some 30 people. No doubt has carried as many daily for many months. and she can tow a 25-ton water barge, which is also part of that man's business. It was a boisterous day, half a gale of wind against the flood tide. Two fellows managed her. A youngster of 17 was Cox,
and a first-rate Cox he was too.
A fellow in a torn blue jersey, not much older, of the usual riverside type, looked after the engine. I spent an hour and a half in her, running up and down and across that reach. She handled perfectly. With 8 or 12 oars out, she could not have done anything like as well. These two youngsters at my request kept her stationary for 10 minutes, with a touch of engine and helm now and then, within 3 feet of a big ugly mooring buoy over which the water broke, and the spray flew in sheets, and which would have holed her, if she had bumped against it. But she kept her position, it seemed to me, to an inch, without apparently any trouble to these boys. You could not have done it with oars. And her engine did not take up the space of 3 men, even on the assumption that you would pack people as tight as sardines in a box. Not the room of 3 people, I tell you. But no one would want to pack a boat like a sardine box. There must be room enough to handle the oars. But in that old ship's boat, even if she had been desperately overcrowded, there was power
manageable by 2 riverside youngsters.
To get away quickly from a ship's side,
very important for your safety, and to make room for other boats,
the power to keep her easily head to sea, the power to move at 5 to 7 knots towards a rescuing ship, the power to come safely alongside. And all that in an engine which did not take up the room of 3 people. A poor boatman who had to scrape together painfully the few sovereigns of the price, had the idea of putting that engine into his boat. But all these designers, directors, managers, constructors, and others whom we may include in the generic name of Yamsey, never thought of it for the boats of the biggest tank on earth, or rather on sea. And therefore they assume an air of impatient superiority and make objections, however sick at heart they may be. And I hope they are, at least, as much as a grocer who has sold a tin of imperfect salmon which destroyed only 6 people. And you know, the tinning of salmon was progress as much at least as the building of the Titanic. More, in fact. I am not attacking shipowners. I care neither more nor less for lines, companies, combines, and generally for trade arrayed in purple and fine linen than the trade cares for me. But I am attacking foolish arrogance, which is fair game, the offensive posture of superiority by which they hide the sense of their guilt, while the echoes of the miserably hypocritical cries along the alleyways of that ship, "Nigh more women? Any more women?" linger yet in our ears. I have been expecting from one, or the other of them all bearing the generic name of Yamsey, something, a sign of some sort, some sincere utterance, in the course of this admirable inquiry, of manly, of genuine compunction. In vain. All trade talk. Not a whisper except for the conventional expression of regret at the beginning of the yearly report, which otherwise is a cheerful document. Dividends, you know. The shop is doing well. And the admirable inquiry goes on, punctuated by idiotic laughter, by paid-for cries of indignation from under legal wigs, bringing to light the psychology of various commercial characters too stupid to know that they are giving themselves away an admirably laborious inquiry into facts that speak, they shout, for themselves. I am not a soft-headed, humanitarian faddist. I have been ordered in my time to do dangerous work. I have ordered others to do dangerous work. I have never ordered a man to do any work I was not prepared to do myself. I attach no exaggerated value to human life. But I know it has a value for which the most generous contributions to the Mansion House and Heroes Funds cannot pay. And they cannot pay for it, because people, even of the third class, excuse my plain speaking, are not cattle. Death has its sting. If Yamsey's manager's head were forcibly held under the water of his bath for some little time, he would soon discover that it has. Some people can only learn from that sort of experience which comes home to their own dear selves. I am not a sentimentalist, therefore it is not a great consolation to me to see all these people breveted as heroes by the penny and halfpenny press. It is no consolation at all. In extremity, in the worst extremity, the majority of people, even of common people, will behave decently. It's a fact of which only the journalists don't seem aware. Hence their enthusiasm, I suppose. But I, who am not a sentimentalist, think it would have been finer if the band of the Titanic had been quietly saved, instead of being drowned, while playing whatever tune they were playing, the poor devils. I would rather they had been saved to support their families than to see their families supported by the magnificent generosity of the subscribers. I am not consoled by the false, written up, Drury Lane aspects of that event, which is neither drama, nor melodrama, nor tragedy, but the exposure of arrogant folly. There is nothing more heroic in being drowned very much against your will, off a old helpless big tank in which you bought your passage, than in dying of colic caused by the imperfect salmon in the tin you bought from your grocer. And that's the truth. The unsentimental truth stripped of the romantic garment the press has wrapped around this most unnecessary disaster. Protection of Ocean Liners 8, 1914. The loss of the Empress of Ireland awakens feelings somewhat different from those the sinking of the Titanic had called upon two continents. The grief for the lost, and the sympathy for the survivors, and the bereaved are the same, but there is not, and there cannot be, the same undercurrent of indignation. The good ship that is gone, I remember reading of her launch something like 8 years ago, had not been ushered in with beat of drum as the chief wonder of the world of waters. The company who owned her had no agents, authorized or unauthorized, giving boastful interviews about her unsinkability to newspaper reporters ready to swallow any sort of trade statement, if only sensational enough for their readers as ignorant as themselves of the nature of all things, outside the commonest experience of the man in the street. No, there was nothing of that in her case. The company was content to have as fine, staunch, seaworthy a ship as the technical knowledge of that time could make her. In fact, she was as safe a ship as 999 ships out of any 1,000 now afloat upon the sea. No, whatever sorrow one can feel, one does not feel indignation. This was not an accident of a very boastful marine transportation. This was a real casualty of the sea. The indignation of the New South Wales Premier flashed telegraphically to Canada is perfectly uncalled for. That statesman, whose sympathy for poor mates and seamen is so suspect to me that I wouldn't take it at 50% discount, does not seem to know that a British Court of Marine Inquiry, ordinary or extraordinary, is not a contrivance for catching scapegoats. I, who have been seaman, mate and master for 20 years, holding my certificate under the Board of Trade, may safely say that none of us ever felt in danger of unfair treatment from a court of inquiry. It is a perfectly impartial tribunal which has never punished seamen for the faults of shipowners as, indeed, it could not do, even if it wanted to. And there is another thing the angry Premier of New South Wales does not know. It is this. That for a ship to float for 15 minutes after receiving such a blow by a bare stem on her bare side is not so bad. She took a tremendous list which made the minutes of grace vouchsafed her of not much use for the saving of lives. But for that neither her owners nor her officers are responsible. It would have been wonderful if she had not listed with such a hole in her side. Even the Aquitania with such an opening in her outer hull would be bound to take a list. I don't say this with the intention of disparaging this latest triumph of marine architecture, to use the consecrated phrase. The Aquitania is a magnificent ship. I believe she would bear her people unscathed through 99% of all possible accidents of the sea. But suppose a collision out on the ocean involving damage as extensive as this one was, and suppose then a gale of wind coming on. Even the Aquitania would not be quite seaworthy, for she would not be manageable. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.